It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, is it possible that technology could actually make us less capable of handling life for ourselves? We explore that question later on.
First, we're talking about a growing trend in Wisconsin schools providing in-house mental health services. Some state school districts are national leaders when it comes to school mental health programs.
One of the first adopters of such a program is the Menasha Joint School District. Here to talk about that program and how it's changed things for students in the Fox Valley is Mary Wisnett. She's a program officer for United Way Fox Cities. Mary, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So the program in Fox Valley Schools, it's called United Way's Path for Students. What's the idea behind it?
Well, the idea is to eliminate barriers to care for kids who are unable to access care in the community. And one of the things that we found is that, unfortunately, there are barriers besides just financial barriers, which is really what you commonly think of when you think of why people aren't receiving medical services. But there's also transportation barriers, and there's parent work schedules that don't permit them to take time off work to take their child to an appointment in the community. So when we realized all of these barriers were impacting some of the statistics that we were seeing around our kids, we thought, well, if we can't bring the kids to the appointment, let's bring the appointment to the kids. And hopefully they're spending most of their time in school. So we started a school-based program in 2008. And we piloted it in the Menasha Joint School District just to see if it was going to work. And since then, it's had enormously successful results. And so we've expanded to 9 other school districts. So we are in 10 school districts and 23 different schools in the Fox Cities.
So you bring the mental health services to the students in the schools. How does it work?
Well, teachers or counselors may identify a student that is having some issues, and typically they would refer them to a clinic in the community. But if those students have barriers to care, as I mentioned before, then they'll refer them to the PATH program. And our licensed therapists are the very same kinds of therapists that a student might see in the community. They do have particular expertise in dealing with issues around children and adolescents. And so they come to the schools, and they provide the exact same level of service that they would at their home site.
Okay, and how did this program get started? What was the initiative?
Well, in the Fox Cities, we do a community assessment every 5 years. And in 2006, when the Life Study came out, that's the name of our assessment, we found some pretty startling data. We saw that 25% of our local 10th graders reported having experienced depression within the last 30 days. And even more startling, 14% said they had attempted suicide.
Hmm.
So the volunteers at United Way really wanted to look at that issue and figure out why kids weren't getting to the services in the community. And that's when they realized that there were barriers to care, and they developed the PATH program.
So you cited those statistics, 25% of kids experiencing depression, 14% having attempted suicide. Did those numbers start to turn around for you when PATH got implemented?
Well, yeah, I hesitate to say that we're the sole reason some of those numbers have turned around, but we have seen a bit of improvement. When the 2011 Life Study came out, we saw that 21% of students reported that they had experienced some form of depression in the last 30 days, and 10% had attempted suicide. So the numbers have gone down a little bit, but I would hesitate to take full credit for that,
mm-hmm.
Because our community has really come together to address mental health services on a community-wide level. So we are just one of the elements in the Fox Cities that's really working to address that problem.
Well, and how has it impacted the community as a whole?
Well, you know, I can certainly cite our outcome results, because we measure outcomes in two major areas. One is we certainly want the kids that we're taking care of to have improved mental health services and to have improved mental health. And then we also measure outcomes related to school performance. So if their grades have been suffering because of their mental health issues, are their grades now getting better? If they've had a lot of suspensions, detentions, unexcused absences, absences, are those getting better because of their services? And when we can cite data, you know, about 72% of the kids are showing improved functioning and reduced symptoms as a result of PATH.
You can finish.
About 63% are showing improved school performance, both grades, improved grades, as well as improved school behaviors. But, you know, when you kind of get past all of the data, one of the easiest ways to explain success of the program is a quote from the principal of Menasha High School, Dr. Larry Hazy. When he was asked what was the benefit of the PATH program to Menasha High School, he said, "Without this program, these kids would not have graduated from high school." So I think while there's lots of data and so on, that probably is the most meaningful piece of information, that we're giving kids the necessary coping skills so that they are able to be successful in school and then ultimately be successful in life.
So based on your experience with the program, would you say that this is something that should possibly be adopted statewide?
We certainly think so, and we've also seen a lot of other communities that have seen some of the results of our program and have been approaching us to start a program in their community. We've been approached by Racine, by Sheboygan, by Waukesha, and as far away as Sioux Falls, South Dakota. So there certainly is a movement of individual communities to develop a program. But it would be wonderful if we could have some sort of state initiative that would really promote it for all communities, because really there are kids that are just falling through the cracks because they're not able to access very good services in the community, but they're just not able to get there.
How widespread is it? You mentioned your district, and I know there are some others, but how many schools would you say have it?
In our Fox Cities, we're in 23 buildings. We would love to be in every single school in the Fox Cities, but, you know, there's limited resources. So each district picks what schools they feel have the greatest need, and then those are the schools that we're serving right now. But I'm sure that there's, anytime you talk to a school professional, they will tell you, we would love to have PATH in our school too. So I think it's a pretty widespread issue. And, you know, some of the latest statistics we've seen is that anywhere from 20 to 25% of children and adolescents have some sort of mental health issue. So I think it is a pretty serious concern.
In terms of schools that might want to adopt it but see some barriers, one of them might be cost. How does the program get funded?
Right now, we are funding the program in two major ways. One is we bill third-party payers whenever possible. So if families have insurance coverage, if kids are on Badger Care, we certainly bill those. We work with licensed professional agencies, so they are all capable of billing third-party payers. But then we also rely heavily on philanthropic dollars. We've been very fortunate to get a grant from our local community foundation through a basic needs giving partnership that involves a number of foundations within the Fox Cities. And then United Way, of course, also supports the program.
Well, Mary, thanks so much for coming on and telling us about it.
Well, thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Mary Wisnett, Program Officer for United Way Fox City. She was with us to talk about in-school mental health services offered in the Fox Valley, part of a growing trend here in Wisconsin. We live in a technological age where computers navigate our plane, show us how to get from points A to B, and help diagnose health problems.
Technology is allowing us to outsource lots of tasks that we simply don't have time for, but is it helping us in the long run? What do we sacrifice? What do we lose by allowing computers to run the errands, help us socialize, make decisions, and solve problems?
With us now is Deborah Blum, a professor of journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a columnist for the New York Times, and a blogger for Wired. She's also the author of The Poisoner's Handbook, and she edited the 2014 edition of The Best American Science and Nature Writing. Deborah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, one of the pieces in The Best American Science and Nature Writing, which you edited, is called The Great Forgetting. It's by Nicholas Carr. And it's about technology's impact on the way that we think, the way that we respond to things. What is it that we're likely to start forgetting now that we live in the age of apps and computers who can do just about everything for us? Sometimes it feels like.
Well, I love this car piece because it makes you think about the way our brains interact with sort of automation. And he uses some really interesting examples. He really starts with one that's kind of scary, which is he poses this question, what if pilots who are used to putting planes on autopilot forget how to fly, and what happens when the automation fails? So that's a good example of how we can become too dependent on automation. And as we do that, as he argues, our skills diminish and our brains turn off. And I mean, and I can give you an example of what happens when we become too dependent if you want.
Well, before we get to that, this is kind of an age-old argument. You think of the printing press, probably think people were saying similar things. The assembly line. Is there something qualitatively different these days that's putting us more at risk?
Well, I think one of the points that Nicholas Carr makes is that our brains learn by acting. It makes perfect sense. You know, we train our brains. We put them through certain tasks. We sort of lay down neural pathways in which the next time you're in that situation, your brain says, oh, yeah, I know how to do that. But what if you're not training your brain? I mean, this is really the basis of his argument. You're not training your brain to think that way. You're not laying down the sort of, brain cell framework that's going to come back when you need it. You're just letting a machine do it for you. So when you're saying, okay, autopilot, fly my plane, or okay, GPS, make that map and I won't even bother and make a mental map, or okay, machine, do this for me, we're actually learning, we're actually losing skills and abilities, and I think kind of our sort of long history of engaging our brain, we lose some of that. And it's not necessarily catastrophic, but I like it because it makes perfect sense.
And you're right, there are some pretty harrowing examples in the car piece, certainly about flying airplanes. And it seems as that when the computers toss it back to the humans, the humans aren't able to do what they need to do in the right moment. What happens?
So he gave two examples of, speaking of catastrophic results, he gave two examples of planes that crashed. And in both cases, this was really fascinating to me. It was a situation where the instruments didn't work properly, or autopilot turns off when there's a problem. The planes are designed to say, okay, now there's a problem, we need some human judgment. Autopilot turns off, but the pilot is not used to making the decision and has not been actually training his brain to respond to these kind of situations. In this case, in two cases, the plane started slowing down and started to go down. And so the pilot responds by pulling up the nose of the plane, right? Let's get that plane up into a higher altitude. Well, when you pull up the nose of the plane, you're going against gravity and the plane will stall. Hmm. And so in both of these cases, the planes went into stall mode, started to nosedive, and in one case they just couldn't figure out what was going on and never corrected. And in the other case, the pilot literally did not let go of the stick that was pulling the plane upward, and the plane was down in less than a minute, right? And later in the piece, he talks about the training of pilots, in which now the FAA is saying, you need to turn off all autopilot so pilots can actually train their brains to make judgment. And we have a concern that we're forgetting how to fly. And he raises the question, you know, Google car, the car that'll drive itself. What happens when we're all doing that? And what happens when, say, that computer dies? Will we know how to drive? Will our brains have that capacity? So it's, are we putting ourselves at risk by becoming too dependent, and are we becoming dumber?
But it seems like there's a trade-off. Maybe the normal case and the technology is working, it's actually safer. Say you see a lot of drivers on the road where you wish a computer was driving their car for them. And so the norm is safer enough that those exceptional occurrences don't balance it out and it's still a net positive.
Yes. And so, yeah, most of the time you can make an argument that autopilot has been much safer because people's attention drift. Mm-hmm. So, but it is always a, yeah, but if something works, you want the pilot to know what he's doing, right? And as we get more and more into this, are we going to put more and more people at risk? So, yeah, there is the argument for safety. I think that's a fair argument. I think there is also an argument that we still don't want to lose those skills. In that sense, the plane's an extreme example, Right. I think about it more in my own life with GPS. I go down to Chicago to visit my son there. I don't have a clue what Chicago's like. I plug in the address and I go. And every once in a while, I'll say to myself, where does my son live exactly? Mm-hmm. But I don't know. And I realize that if someone stole my phone or I broke it or something, I'd be hopeless. I could never navigate. I have no picture in my mind. I have no idea where he lives, right? So I've lost that ability to rescue myself. And at some level, we all want to maintain our ability to rescue ourselves from catastrophic situations.
And Nicholas Carr makes the point in his piece that we're kind of just at the beginning of this. Mm-hmm. We think that computers do so much, but really we've just begun to tiptoe through that door, and there's no telling what computers could eventually do for the human race, what they could take over in our day-to-day lives. Should we be worried about that and start preparing now?
Well, I don't feel like in a sci-fi sense. I mean, there's like arguments about artificial intelligence and whether, you know, in the kind of Stanley Kubrick way, eventually the automation will run us. But I do think that we can be smart about recognizing the risk. Like one of the points that Nicholas Carr makes is that in some programs now, they randomly just shut it off. You know, you're like sitting there, your plane's on autopilot, you're on autopilot, but what if you knew at some random point it was going to turn off? Then you would have to pay attention. And so his point is we have to figure out ways, even as automation increases, to keep ourselves engaged with the process and to keep ourselves part of the process. And I think he's right. I think we're smart enough to develop automation, and we're smart enough to get ahead of it.
You know, it seems like maybe a better approach is the humans in control and the technology is giving a nudge. And I'm thinking like mm-hmm. new cars that you can switch on a thing that says, hey, you just turn on your right turn signal. I'm detecting something over there. Maybe give an extra look so that we're still in control and the computer is alerting us to potential trouble.
That's a smart idea, because what you really want is to keep yourself engaged, right? So imagine that you had your car, you're driving your cool Google car, you're on autopilot, something, you know, some switch goes off and the car starts veering all over the road, but you weren't paying attention. So we've got to build into these systems like kind of checkpoints like you're talking about, hey, you. In which we're still engaged in the process. And also, you know, we want to be smart. We want our brains to work in all kinds of interesting ways. We want to keep all those complex neural pathways that make us who we are. And so the other thing to remember is, you know, there's things about the good old days in which you had to constantly think for yourself. Maybe you weren't always as perfect about it as a computer, but man, you were smart. We want to keep that.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible that the computers, though, they're just freeing us up to think about grander things, loftier things?
And writing so we can, white operas, yeah.
Right, so we can stay a step ahead of them?
You know, and that's one of the arguments for it. If we just automate everything, that we'll all, then we're all free to be complete geniuses.
Right.
I kind of love that. I'm still waiting for my genius moment, actually. But, you know, you could go back to something as simple as the washing machine. There was a big argument that when washing machines were invented, women would, and women did all the washing, so I'm using women, that they'd be freed up to go out and be geniuses and do other things. But the problem is, once you had a washing machine, then you washed your clothes more often. We got more used to being clean all the time. So pretty soon you're putting just as much time into laundry as you were when you only washed every 2 weeks when it was a big hassle, right? So you have to also think, what's the consequence of using this technology?
Do we think about what's the consequences of using this technology as a rule?
No, never. I think we just go, oh, this is so cool, let's do it. And I think we do that not just with technology, but with all kinds of next best things, right? I love this idea. And frankly, when I am driving around with my teenage son as he learns to drive, I'm like, where is that Google car? I just feel so much safer. So I'm going to be riding. I mean, I can't wait for it myself.
Now, briefly here, as we get towards the end of our time together, is this something that's just inevitable? Computers are going to get better. They're ascendant. We're descendant. And, you know, things are not looking good for us as a species in terms of intelligence and what we do. Is that part of what we just maybe have to make peace with?
You know, that's a good, I mean, I like to think that we're still, after I just trashed the idea that automation allows us to become more brilliant, I would like to think that we're going to continue to be smarter about this, that people like Nicholas Carr, who is a wonderful writer, and other people who think about it will say, oh, hello, you know, red flag, let's stop, let's think and be smart about where this is wanting to go so that we'll actually make some intelligent choices. Here's what we want this to do. Here's how we're going to make best use to it. And here's how we're going to remember that the human mind is still a wonderful thing and we want to take good care of it.
Thanks a lot for joining us today, Deborah.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
That was Deborah Blum. She's a professor of journalism at UW-Madison. She's the author of The Poisoner's Handbook, and she edited the 2014 edition of The Best American Science and Nature Writing. When the rest of the world thinks about Wisconsin, there's a good chance that agriculture, especially dairy farming, are among the first things that pop into their heads.
But does that match up with the economic reality in the state? A new report aims to measure the impact of agriculture in Wisconsin and which kinds of farming are on the rise or on the decline.
That report is called The Contribution of Agriculture to the Wisconsin Economy, and the author joins us now here in the studio. Stephen Deller is professor and community development economist at the UW-Madison Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. Steve, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So we probably all have a sense that agriculture is a big deal here in Wisconsin, no surprise there, but how big is it as part of our economy?
Well, there's really two parts of agriculture. One is on-farm. Most folks think of Wisconsin, they think of dairy farming. But agriculture really is, there's a tremendous amount of food processing that goes on in the state. I mean, 80 to 90% of all the milk that is produced in Wisconsin actually goes into a manufactured product, primarily cheese. So when you think about agriculture as both farming and food processing, you're looking at, at least 10, 11% of the state's economy is can be traced back to agriculture.
And are we also talking about things like, when you think about the auto industry in Detroit, there's also the parts supplier out there and things like that. Are we talking about support like, veterinary services and things like that?
Yeah, there's really, there's really two ways that farming contributes to the state's economy. One is that they're buying inputs. They're buying veterinarian services. They're buying feed. They're buying canning. They're buying equipment. But they also are taking their wages that they're earning, the labor that's there, and they're spending that money in the local economy. So it's really kind of a two-part component here.
And how big a player is the agricultural economy writ large, as you were saying, when it comes to jobs?
In total, agriculture contributes about 413,000 jobs, and that's about 12% of the state's total in terms of jobs.
Well, let's look at this report. Is one you've done a few times now. It's recurring, I think, every 5 years. Is that right?
Yeah, we do it every 5 years so that it lines up with the census of agriculture that comes out every 5 years.
So 2009, we just had that crash. In 2008, we're in the Great Recession. How have things changed between then and now?
You know, when you think about agriculture, you generally don't think of a stable sector of the economy. You think of agriculture as kind of bouncing around depending on weather and things like that. But when you look at how Wisconsin agriculture and food processing performed through the Great Recession, it was actually a stabilizing factor, which I was very surprised to find that.
Well, if you think about it, we're always going to need to eat, I guess. So there's a limit as to how low demand could go.
That's true. But you see, people will tend to cut back on how they're eating and their shift how they're eating and whatnot. And you'll see that ripple through. But we've generally did not find. I mean, you can look at the trends and you can say, oh, there's the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. But it was very modest downturn.
Mm-hmm. So, but it's not like a luxury industry, say,
exactly.
Powerboats and things like
exactly.
that. So let's look at different sectors now. As I mentioned earlier, dairy stands out when people think of Wisconsin. How big a part of our state's agricultural scene is dairy?
Well, if you look at all of dairy combined, that would be farming and processing, which again is primarily cheese, you're looking at about 79,000 jobs. About $7 billion in terms of income. So you're looking at a fairly large part of agriculture in Wisconsin is attributed to dairy. But a lot of the growth has been occurring in other parts of Wisconsin agriculture. Cranberry, for example. This wasn't a good year for cranberry because of what happened to prices. But there are other parts of Wisconsin agriculture that are growing. The brewery industry is coming back to the state. The grape industry and winery industry is growing in the state.
So are we seeing a transition from being mostly commodity dependent, I'm thinking, you know, corn, milk, things like that, to some kind of value-added product like beer, wine, cheese.
Yeah, I think what we're going to see is really more of this trend of large commodity where it is, a certain grade of milk, period. That's what the big cheese processors need, and they're making a commodity cheese. But I think we're also seeing a more arsenial market, if I can use that phrase, which is more, a branded. So it's kind of separating out a commodity to a product. Mm-hmm. We're seeing that with the growth of the local foods movement. In terms of the absolute size, the local foods movement is still it's tiny in comparison to traditional commodity agriculture. But we're seeing growth in that area.
Well, there's been a lot of attention too in artisan cheesemakers, smaller breweries, things like that. And as you mentioned, the local food movement, still a small part. Does that mean it's always going to be a small part, or is this lots of room for growth?
Well, two things. One is there is the potential for growth, but for Wisconsin in particular, because of the demographics. I mean, we've got the Chicago metropolitan area to the south of us, and we got the Twin Cities to the north and west of us, which are huge markets to tap into. Now, is that local foods? I think it is. It's a local market. It's a regional market. So the potential to tap into those is very, very strong. But the other thing is that we have pretty good data on what is called by the census is sales for human consumption. That's things like farmers markets, roadside stands, CSA-type farms, things like that. We have really good data on that. But this other component of the local foods is selling to restaurants, selling to local grocery stores, selling to local hospitals. We have no idea how big that market is.
Really?
None.
So I guess this would be the federal ag department doesn't track that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Now, I know you would want your finger on that pulse. Are there ways you think that could be measured?
Yeah, there is. And we're trying to convince the U.S. Department of Agriculture to maybe modify some of their survey questions so that we can get a better handle on that. But that's easier said than done.
Now, one thing I bet they are trying to measure, I'm not sure how much it comes up in this new report, is how much does Wisconsin export overseas, or at least outside of the United States?
That's actually a growth potential. I mean, one of the things that we did in the study was to kind of break agriculture down into its different components to look and see which sectors were doing well. And one of the ones was these dried and condensed type dairy products that are really, they're being structured for, long-term shipment. Long shelf lives, long-term shipment, a lot of that's going to the international market. So it's a small part, but it's a growing part. So again, we've got this kind of traditional commodity agriculture in Wisconsin, but we've got all these little niche markets of agriculture that are getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Here's one niche that I should ask about. Organic farming gets a lot of attention from public radio listeners, definitely. Is that something that's grown in the last 5-10 years?
It is, but it's not growing in terms of local foods. It's growing in terms of the larger producers. The larger producers have realized that there's a market, and you have some of the larger retailers, if you will, Walmart, for example, is moving this direction. Some of the fast food chains are moving this direction because their customers are demanding it. And so what we're seeing is some of the larger producers changing their production techniques so that they can go into that organic market. So it's a growing market. But it's the growth is coming from larger scale producers.
Right. So it would be hard for a small farmer to keep up with one Walmart store, let alone a Walmart distribution center. Say.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's what economists call transactions cost. There's a great example in western Wisconsin where there was a hospital that wanted to use local produce. And they were running into a problem of having to, write contracts and enforce contracts with 100 different little farmers. And it's just not cost effective. I mean, it's I can write one contract with a wholesaler mm-hmm. and get everything I need, or I have to write 100 contracts and deal with 100 different little farmers. And it doesn't work. So what happened is a group of farmers came together and formed what's called Fifth Season Cooperative, which is essentially a marketing arm. They came together and realized that fifth season cooperative can be the kind of go-between, the farmers and the larger producers. And it's working out to be a real success story.
It's interesting. The byword a lot of times lately seems to be eliminating the middleman. You know, you hear that in ads for appliances and things like that. Here, a middleman was desperately needed.
You need the middleman. And it's, again, it goes back to what economists call transactions costs. That's what that middleman does, is that he essentially connects buyers and sellers, and he absorbs all those costs. It's a very vital part of the economy.
We're talking to UW-Madison community development expert Stephen Deller about his new report on the contribution that agriculture makes to Wisconsin's economy.
And you can join our conversation. Are you a farmer? And what is the economy like where you're working? How important is farming, do you think, to your community? And what about farmers markets? You can call and share your questions and experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now about Wisconsin agriculture and the impact it has on the economy statewide and in local communities.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How important is agriculture, farming, food processing in your part of the state? If you're in the business, how are things going for you? And do you participate in things like farmers markets, farm to school programs, community supported agriculture? Tell us your story and ask your questions as well at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. We're talking to Steve Deller with UW-Madison. He has a new report out on this topic. And Steve, just a few moments ago, we talked about a hospital trying to reach out to local farms. How about schools? You hear sometimes about farm-to-school programs. Are they moving the needle on Wisconsin's farm economy?
There is a growing amount of interest in that. But one of the problems that that program has is that a lot of the funding that the public schools receive for lunch programs or breakfast programs, for example, comes from the federal government. And there's a cap on what the federal government will pay for a meal. I think it's like $1.90. Don't quote me on that. And the problem is that that's much below what the farmers need to make this viable. So what a lot of schools are doing is they're moving it more towards less sourcing of local foods, but more of trying to build a stronger connection between students and the farmers, so that it's more of an educational program, if you will, so that kids get a better appreciation of where their food is coming from.
Hmm. And now when we think farming economy, I think we may think of rural economy. I know in this report you also try to measure the impact of the food industry as a whole on urban Wisconsin.
That's right. When you think about agriculture, you immediately think, well, that's a rural component. And there are some the part of Wisconsin that is the most dependent on agriculture in terms of the percent is southwestern Wisconsin, which is a very rural part of the state. It's very dependent on farming. But actually, when you start thinking about food processing, a lot of those food processors are located in urban areas, particularly the northeast part of Wisconsin, kind of the Green Bay area down to Fond du Lac and whatnot. That region in there is heavily dependent upon food processing for employment. Even when you go into Milwaukee, there are large food processors located in the Milwaukee area. So it's not just a rural issue, it's an urban and rural issue.
We had a caller at 800-642-1234. Couldn't stay on the line, but wonders if we are able to assess the role that Wisconsin's Hmong community plays on agriculture here in the state.
When you look at, in terms of commodity production, they don't have much of a presence, but they are making a very strong presence in the local food movement. They are active in that part, and they are growing to be certain parts of the state. They're becoming a very important part of the local foods movement in terms of the suppliers of commodities. But in terms of commercial, large-scale commercial ag, they're not much of a presence. Mm.
So looking at region by region, you mentioned southwestern Wisconsin as a key player in agriculture and some of the urban areas. In this report, you break down how different regions are doing. Is there an emerging agricultural region, a place where dairy is getting bigger or smaller for that matter?
I don't think that there's much of a change regionally. There's some, the industries here you know, because of the geography of the state. You can go back to the culture of the state as well, but it's a lot of it has to do with the geography of the state. And you're not going to see a whole lot of shifting around in terms of that. But you will see some differences in terms of maybe where some of the smaller scale food processors are coming up. I think that there's a growth in the southwestern part of the state because there's this growth in local foods. A lot of the land in the southwestern part of the state is not conducive to large scale commercial, but it's very, it's ideal for the smaller scale. Now the question is are those smaller scale operations viable business enterprises? And that's one of the things the local food movement right now is really devoting a lot of its attention to is how do we make these smaller operations profitable? Again, it's the same thing. That middleman used to be a dirty word. Well, now they're coming to the realization that they play an important role. Profit was also kind of a dirty word. And now folks are coming to realize that if this is to be sustainable, it has to make a profit.
To a caller now at 800-642-1234. We have Mark with us in Richland Center. Mark, hi.
Hello. I wanted to mention Will Allen in Milwaukee with his group called Growing Power because he's simply part of a large group of urban farmers whose economic model is altogether different than what you just mentioned with regard to profit and such because they don't really want to grow food necessarily to sell it into the marketplace but simply to consume it. So community gardens and school-to-garden things and abandoning the market altogether, grow your food, can it, put it away until whenever you need to use it or eat it directly from the garden is a perfectly reasonable economic model. And if you look at what's happening in Detroit and Milwaukee and Chicago and all of the urban farming that's going on, this economic model is huge.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. Brings up some great points. It might, Steve, be hard to measure that from an economic standpoint because they're not going to market. They're not generating those measurable numbers. But do you see an impact from those?
In terms of the economic impact, there really isn't much. I mean, in terms of the impact on the individual family, it could be huge. But in terms of the larger economy, it's really not that big of a market, or I shouldn't say a market, but that large of a segment. The one thing, though, that is happening with a lot of these urban gardens in particular is that it's not really an economic development strategy in terms of jobs and whatnot. It's a community development strategy. It's building social capital within that community. There's evidence where gang activity, if you take a vacant lot and you turn it into a community garden, there's some evidence that that actually kind of deters crime within that area. I can come up with nice stories, but, you know, why that's happening is I think, a fascinating question. So I think that these urban gardens may not be an economic development strategy, but they're a great community development strategy.
Mark, thanks so much for the call. Back to the phones now with Jay in Hancock. Jay, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Jay?
Well, I got into this conversation a little bit late, and I apologize. It sounds like a small farming wonderful things. You were just talking about the economic advantages and profits of large-scale farming. I live in the Central Sands area, and in the last 20 years, we've seen thousands of acres of forestry turned over for large-scale ag and crop growing. In our case, they're growing potato chips across the street from us. At what point does that profit for agriculture supersede tourism, weekend campers coming up from the city and, you know, just taking over the environment with their large-scale farming.
Jay, thanks a lot for the call. So weighing the benefits of a large agricultural operation versus whatever else you might be doing with that plot of land, Steve.
There is no correct answer to that question because it's a value statement. You could get 10 people in a room, ask those 10 people that exact question, and you're going to get 10 different answers. This is where it really comes down to choices at the individual community level. I'm dealing a lot with frac sand mining and how that plays out. And it's the exact same issues in terms of do we dig up the sand and sell it and make lots of money, or do we preserve the wildlife and the heritage of the area? And for one community, the decision may be we want to promote frac sand mining. We want to do it in an environmentally sensitive way. We want to go that way. Another community could say, you know, nope, we don't want frac sand mining. So there really is no clean answer. It's going to vary by what the community wants.
Now, big picture, looking at how things like federal policy and state policy affect us, affect the economic impact of agriculture in Wisconsin, are there any big question marks out there, any big things that stand out to you?
One of the things that is happening with the Farm Bill that was passed last year.
After a lot of delay.
Which is normal now. Yeah. It's not a 5-year Farm Bill, it's a 7-year Farm Bill. Is kind of the movement away from traditional price supports, the movement towards things like insurance. So there's been some transitions in the terms of way in which the federal government is trying to provide some safety net for the farm industry. I don't think that's going to affect consumers very much, but it will affect how farmers have to think about their business decision-making.
Now it's harvest time for a lot of farmers. We're having warm, dry weather around the state. Looking at this year in particular, Steve, a banner year for Wisconsin agriculture, or are there areas of concern?
So far, everything looks pretty good. There is always the potential, and this is what happened to cranberries. They had a bumper crop, and what happens to price? It drops. So we could be in a position of Wisconsin doing fairly well in terms of yields. Yields are going to be good. In terms of feed prices to dairy farmers, that could be good. But we could be in the same situation where everybody has a good growing year, we overproduce, and prices plummet. And that's why you think of agriculture as an unstable industry, because of things like that.
That's one of those quirky parts of the business. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Stephen Deller. He's a professor and community development economist at the UW-Madison Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. We've been talking about his new report on the impact on Wisconsin's economy of agriculture.